Welcome to The Market Tech, a live podcast series where leadership and product marketing intersect. The Market Tech is brought to you by our friends at the Compete Network. Thank you for all your support in bringing this to life. And we have my co-host and friend, Morgan Jam Master Jay Ingram. Hello, my friend. And, you know, it's so hard to keep track of you because every time I check you, you're either at home in Arizona. I don't know if you moved back to Atlanta and had enough of Arizona, or in Berlin. Is that you're going there for the Euros, I think. Atlanta.
I'm going next week for the Euros, yes.
Down doing LinkedIn things. Where the hell are you today?
I've been Arizona. I'm now here. I'm not going anywhere crazy until I go next week to the European Cup, which should be fun.
Fantastic. You know, I love having Morgan alongside of us. It keeps us B2B marketers real with that healthy dose of sales perspectives to say, time out. What are you guys doing over there on that side? They won't use it. They won't say that. And that's not how the customer speaks to them. So Morgan's here to keep it real for us. So welcome, Morgan, again. And today we have two gentlemen who have taken the product marketing world by storm over the past 18 months. And how? I mean, these guys have positioned themselves in such a compelling way. Hell, you go to their LinkedIn profile, go to Anthony's profile right now, but make sure you come back and take a peek at his banner. I help founders market hard-to-market products. I help benefit founders, persona, market capability, hard to market, the problem, products, the feature, product marketing, and go to market for early stage startups. Your category, your ICP. This is pragmatically how you need to do it. You go to their website, fletchpmm.com, and just look at their hero statement. It's not, we are going to quadruple your revenue through your number one converting asset and blah, blah, blah. It's, let's rewrite your confusing homepage. This is the simplicity of the position, message, copyright that they've been preaching for the past couple of years now. And it's a thing to behold and also something to emulate. And I invited them on the show. And just for the record, there is no sponsorship of monetary value on this show, nor will there ever be since I started the community in 2016. I invite people who are going to help our tribe, product marketers, really excel at their craft. So I've invited these gentlemen onto the show because they have something to say and it's worth listening to. So more than ever before, especially in such a competitive environment with the economy being where it's at, positioning and messaging on your homepage matters. So we're going to cover three things today. We're going to set the stage with what is positioning, what is messaging versus copywriting. What are the differences between these three things? We're going to move on to positioning and messaging per your context. So where is your company at? Where is your customer at in their journey, respectively? Do you have one product? Do you have multi-products? Are you serving one persona? Are you serving various functions? There's differences and nuances to how you need to position and message per that. Then we're going to move on to how they tackle the homepage. And finally, we're going to tear down something that they've done in the past from a homepage perspective and really see their craft in action. You guys ready?
So, I mean, Anthony, Rob, I mean, have you ever had a better intro than that? First and foremost,
what? Tough to beat, that's for sure.
Yeah, I know,
the bar,
right?
Has been set.
It's been set really high. I'm like, I don't even know what question we're going to ask next. But, you know, we broke down a couple things. So I think the first part is positioning. I would love to hear from both of you a simple question that probably has a lot of different answers. What is positioning? What does that mean to you? But also, what is it not? So we'll start with Anthony there, then we'll go to Rob on this one.
Yeah. So in our view of positioning, you have three key elements that make up your positioning strategy. It's going to be an audience. It's going to be a competitive alternative. And it's going to be your product's differentiation. And you kind of need all three. We actually don't believe that there is a positioning that's some sort of meta level thing that exists outside of audiences. And these audiences can be different target segments with different needs and desires, and your positioning will look different for different segments potentially. And so those three aspects make up what positioning is: who it's for, right? How they would use it, what they're looking to do. The product differentiation is against that competitive alternative. So I'd say that's like the quick answer. Rob, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I'll dive in here. And I have a visual, if I could bring it up for everybody.
Show
here.
Oh, yeah, let's go.
We love this. Off the start.
So Anthony and I, this question's perfect because Anthony and I, we've been debating these definitions for 2 years. And literally last week, we got to what we think is our most concrete definition of all three of these things. And Anthony structured it perfectly as far as getting into positioning. And I'll double click into all of this. So Anthony nailed it as far as the positioning level here. It's a strategy. It's something you can't see. And when we were getting round and round, and a lot of folks use it in B2B, they talk about your position, which I'll get to in a moment, and they interchange it with positioning, which is you working on the strategy to figure out how are we even going to approach a market made up of your target audience, your competitive alternative, and your product differentiation. You ask, what is it not? Positioning is not messaging, is not copywriting. It lives in that meta strategy level at a higher altitude of just defining those things. When we move down into positioning, we are now shifting from, okay, we've made all those hard strategic decisions of who we're going to focus on, who we're going to compete against, and what we think our differentiation is. Now we're trying to express it. And the big key as it ties to messaging is that it's asset dependent. And so you will have a different messaging strategy for a homepage than you will for a sales deck, than you will for ads, than you will for blogs, than you will for podcasts. They're all different messaging strategies that should connect in some way, shape, or form up to your positioning strategy, but it's a fundamentally different exercise. When you move down a layer from messaging is where you actually get into the asset execution. In our case, we focus exclusively on homepages, sometimes landing pages. And this is where we move into copywriting, where we already know the strategy. We already know the key elements we're going to lean into in our argument. We know kind of the narrative structure we want to follow. Now we're getting into the tactical. What are the exact words and language we're going to use in this asset for this specific channel? All three of those things, when you break them out, and I think the clarity for us is like, and we were unclear, I would say, even when we started 2 years ago, when we were evaluating folks' homepage messaging, what we're really evaluating is their copywriting. We're making an inference on their messaging strategy, and then we're making another inference on their positioning strategy, trying to see back to what were they deciding in the room to make those hard decisions. All of this then has some influence or implication on position, but the hard reality is the position you have really no direct control over. It's a perception. It's a summation of perceptions of all the folks who are in your target market. Different people are going to think different things, and all you can really do is rely on your copywriting, your media creation in channels to try and influence that. That ties back to your positioning and messaging strategies.
Brilliant. And so it starts with the who, is what you're saying. Like, you have to nail your audience, target audience, and who you're going to go after, and that's where it all starts with. When you guys do your exercises, are you looking at who's your audience first?
I'll jump in here, and Anthony might have something to add. So we start with the who, but the real challenge that we bump into, we've gone through a positioning process with about 200 B2B startups. Not everyone knows their who. And so our process is built and designed of starting with the target audience. The hard reality is some folks don't build that way. Some folks don't say, yeah, I actually know who I want to help. And I built this thing and I just don't know who to compete with. And I don't know how to like explain my differentiation. Some folks are just out there. They're technologists. They built some cool shit, and then they go, who might need this? It. Yeah, and exactly. The, you know, if you build it, they will come. And we're like, well, that's not going to work. And so they actually have to work backwards, right? And so the folks here in the middle are starting with, I built this cool thing, and they literally are in target audience discovery. Who is it going to be? And so that's where you kind of tackle the isolation of those three key variables of your positioning strategy differently. And it is hypothesis driven. And then there's even a group out here, we call them more market focused, where they they know the market dynamics, but they actually don't have a really clear sense of the who. Like, they know who they want to beat out, but they don't know who to lead with in order to unlock the differentiation that they're aiming for. This one's more rare, I would say. It's usually one of these first two buckets. And for us, our process, and we'll get into it later today, is definitely this audience-first approach to then back solve for your competitive alternatives and eventually getting to your product differentiation.
So I want to break something down here, because as people are looking at, okay, the strategy of the positioning, right? Because obviously the tactical layers of messaging, copyright, follow up. What if you're working with someone, and maybe people listening in, they're like, okay, I don't have my one avatar. I have like four people I think we could sell to. How are you helping people narrow down like where to start? Is it like, hey, let's do all four and let's test it? Or it's like, we need to stick with one, and if that doesn't work, then we'll pivot to others.
So at a high conceptual level, it's a question of, the first question we try to figure out is, are these actually different segments? Because if you think, like, take a B2C example. Let's say you sell at-home internet routers. The same segment could be someone, a 20-year-old living in Miami, who's trying to get faster internet in their house, and a 75-year-old grandma living in Denver, Colorado, who's also trying to get faster internet for her house. So it comes down to, like, is the use case actually shared between these audiences? In which case, they actually probably are the same segment potentially. And in B2B, we see this a lot. Slack, like, let's take Slack. There's a broader way that Slack could go to market, targeting sales and customer success and marketing, basically talking about just team communication. And there's not like a huge material difference between those segments in, hey, we send messages back and forth. You can obviously go more specific for targeted campaigns where you would say, I'm actually going to target marketing teams. I'm going to use very specific marketing examples. And in general, the more specific you can go in your marketing messaging, usually it's going to be more resonant. And you know that, you know, anything in sales, cold emails, the more targeted you can go, the more that's going to actually work, right? And so it's a question of, first of all, are these actually different segments? If they are different segments, it just raises some more questions that you have to answer. We work primarily with early stage companies, early stage startups that have maybe one marketing person. And they're like, we could be used by these four different industries, financial services, you know, biotech, logistics and supply chain, and any of them could use us. And so we're going to go after all four. And then you have to stop and say, okay, do you have the capacity as a small team to launch four concurrent go-to-market plans and strategies that are all going to be drastically different from each other? And most of the time they can't. So if it's an early stage company, you probably are wanting to do some more prioritization where you can actually say, you know, even though we could service all four, let's try to get some traction in one of them. And once we are making a lot more money, we can actually hire more marketers, more salespeople, and we can layer on the additional segments to go after it. Okay, we've dominated the logistics supply chain. Now we can start going after financial services. And any of those four might be multi-trillion dollar markets. And we'll see examples where, you know, it actually doesn't even make sense to start going after the others because you're getting such good penetration. And then even in larger companies, when you have multiple different segments, if you believe in the concept of an ideal customer profile, an ICP, one, not, I have 10 ICPs, right? We have one ICP that's actually more important. You should probably spend the bulk of your marketing dollars and positioning strategy effort around positioning your product for them primarily. If that's where, you know, if there's a group of customers that you make the most money from, they're the easiest to reach, they have the best word of mouth, they have the best NPS, you know, upsells, all that stuff, you probably want to mostly focus on them and deprioritize the other groups.
Brilliant. If you don't mind, let's just do a quick recap on the first question, and then we have a question from the audience. So for positioning versus messaging, let's leave copywriting aside. Can you just do a quick recap on position versus messaging? What's the difference? And then I'll ask the question from the audience.
The fundamental difference, positioning is really just a strategy exercise. And what you're doing is you're making a key decision on three elements. Who's your target audience? Who are you competing with for that target audience? And what's your product differentiation relative to that competition? That's positioning. Plain and simple. It's all strategy. It's inside. No one can truly see it. They can only make best guesses when they bump into your assets and your copy that's out there. messaging strategy, similarly, is a strategy. It's somewhat invisible. It's where you're moving from, hey, we have this positioning of those three key elements. What pieces of it are we going to pull into specific assets and channels? So it's messaging strategies are always asset and channel dependent, and it's around prioritization. It's around figuring out the order of the arguments we want to make. And then the jump into execution is where you get to copywriting, video production, all the things depending on channel and the asset. That's where you're actually translating your messaging into something tangible. And that's what your market's going to interact with.
Interesting. So great segue to this question. Thanks, Kamesh, for the question. If you keep changing your messaging for each asset type, would that not be confusing to your target audience?
Well, it depends. Do you have multiple audiences, right? Going back to what Anthony said, and then the early stage folks we work with, like as far as finding fit and taking advantage of like owning one small market and then growing, ideally you just have one audience. And so there's consistency. Oh, you show up the same way and you say the same thing on Twitter, in cold emails, in podcasts like this, to where there is no confusion. I think what is being described in the question is, isn't it confusing when you have multiple audience? And the answer is, hell yeah, that's the issue. Is companies try and come up with this universal set of messaging. That's like one approach, but then it doesn't resonate with any of these different pieces. Or they do the hard work to split message. Then it becomes a tactical problem of, are we getting the right message in front of the right people in the right channel at the right time? And if you do it right, that organization of where those live actually eliminates the confusion. Because when I'm a founder and I need to see a founder message based on a product we're considering, I see it to where when my team, who is a tactical, we'll say ops director, sees a separate message, it actually drives clarity and then allows us, me and my ops person, to have a conversation in a, you know, really quality way around what we're trying to get out of different products and how we might implement them. Anthony, I don't know if you have anything to add on that tied to the question, but I think that's how we'd approach it.
I think you did a great job summarizing it.
So going back to positioning, you know, when people ask me all the time, I'm a practitioner, you know, I advise on the side, but I'm a practitioner. I'm in product marketing every single day. And then I have these clients on the side who come to me and say, Rowan, how should we position our product? And I'm like, oh, mother of God. And I answer the question with a question. And I think you guys do the same thing. Again, for whom and what do they know? I saw one of your posts, and you guys have phenomenal, many phenomenal posts on the three different, you know, distinct phases of positioning. Can you just elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, let me share my screen actually, because this one is also a good one.
While Anthony's bringing that up, that question, Rowan, of how should I position, is equivalent to asking a complete stranger who you should marry. It's the existential question. And the truth is, you have to figure that out. Someone else can't tell you what it is. Go ahead, Anthony.
So in general, markets, segments have different levels of maturity as it relates to the thing that you're selling. And we know this intuitively, but when it actually gets to the brass tacks of trying to figure out what you're going to say, sometimes people forget this. And so I want to imagine that it's early 2000s, and you are a company that is selling an ice bath. So this is before cold plunges, you know, cold water immersion became this big wellness tactic. And you're going out there and you're basically talking about, hey, I've made an amazing ice bath, and you're trying to sell it. If you start to say, we are the best ice bath, we are way better than all the other ice baths, right? We have really strong temperature control, where it's easy to fill up. People will be like, okay, well, why would I need an ice bath? And we're like, well, it's because you could do cold plunges. And they're like, what? That sounds horrible. You're saying you want me to get in the ice bath? I was assuming this was for some sort of food or something that you're trying to, or drinks that you're trying to, like, is this a, you know? And so you have to walk back that if the segment you're going after doesn't even do the activities that would be required by your product, we would call them in stage one. They're a very immature market segment related to a product. So when you position in stage one, you don't compare yourself to other products in your category. You don't even compare yourself to other types of categories of solutions for the activities. You actually have to first lead your positioning around getting people to want to do the activities that would be required by your product. And the way you do this is you anchor the message on a desired outcome that ideally is unmet. So you start with the desired outcome of, let's say these are like fitness people. These fitness people, if they want to enhance mental resilience, so that's the audience, people who want to do that, don't do, and then you can bring in a competitive alternative, something that maybe that they're doing, right? Don't do daily mindfulness meditation, because that's going to take really long before you see any meaningful results. Instead, you should consider doing daily cold plunges, because when you endure this discomfort, it actually builds this mental resilience and toughness way faster than meditation would. So you can see right here, we have the three different pillars of positioning in here. We have the audience up here, people who want to do this. We have the competitive alternative, which at this point is actually just a different activity. It's not a vendor. It's not even product category or solution. It's just different activities that they might be doing. And what we're trying to do is get the market that we're going after to want to do these activities. Now let's fast forward. It's 2010, maybe 2012 or something like that. We've had some really big influencers go on shows like Joe Rogan and start evangelizing the idea of daily cold plunges. And now the market actually wants to do daily cold plunges. So it's gone from something that they were pushing to now, yeah, I'm a person who's trying to do daily cold plunges. And then the positioning shifts again. In stage two, like an emerging market, the competitive alternative changes. It's no longer a different activity. It's a different mechanism of accomplishing the activity. So maybe a lot of people, when they started doing cold plunges, would be like, I should just do a cold shower. That's probably going to give me the same results. So if you want to do a daily cold plunge, here's a competitive alternative. Don't use a cold shower. You're not going to be able to get it cold enough to get the benefits you want. Now we're positioning the type of product category that we're trying to sell. What you should really consider is getting an ice bath. And at this point, you can say, you know, ice baths are way more controlled experience. They're way better than cold showers. If then the market gets even more mature, which I would argue the cold plunge ice bath market is not even here. This is where it's actually like very red ocean, extremely competitive, all that type of stuff. You move into stage three, where the bulk of the market is actually trying to buy an ice bath. So we've moved right from something we're suggesting to now something that everyone is wanting. And at this point, you actually have to do basically head-to-head positioning against other products in your category, because the bulk of the people want to buy an ice bath, right? So you might say, don't get one of these really crazy expensive ones. They have all these bells and whistles. You're never going to use them. You should instead buy our product, which is the Ice Pod. And it's everything you need, but at a fraction of the cost, whatever that might look like. And so these stages become really, really important, because companies will position in the wrong spot, which leads all sorts of problems. You'll get some people who think that they're doing positioning style, basically like they're in stage three. This is like a lot of startups that go to market and are watching the other small startups to determine what to do. So they'll be like, well, this Y Combinator company is getting a lot of attention. We should really say why we're better than them, when the bulk of the market might be all the way up here and not even understand what the activities are that would matter to use the product. And so they're saying, well, we're way better than this YC company because we have this feature, this, and no one is even in the awareness stage at all. A lot of times we'll see companies that will go to market here, and they're actually in a very red ocean market. So you'll see a new to-do list app, and they'll be like, hey, we're super great at, you know, making your life more organized. We're a to-do list app. It's like, yes, I already know that to-do list apps are more organized. I know that I want to use them for organizing my tasks. I actually just want to know, why should I use you instead of Asana? You know, why would I use you instead of... And so companies that come into play here, like a new email client or a new web browser, everyone is already looking for web browsers. And so you immediately have to differentiate against other products. And so there's a company we always reference, Arc Browser. On their homepage, it literally says in the H1 of the hero, your Google Chrome replacement. So they're like, we're going right after head-to-head. They don't have to explain why would you want to use a web browser? What would you do with a web browser? Because the market is in stage three. So they're able to position in the right way that helps contextualize it and puts their product in the best light.
The only addition I'd add to that is, like, in addition to being in the wrong stage at the wrong time in the strategy, the other big issue we see is folks try and live across all three stages in the way that they then translate it to messaging and copy. And you've read these pages. They're like, hey, there's this really big problem you got to solve, and you got to solve it with this tool, but we're better than these other tools, and you don't do these other activities. It's like scatterbrain. They're trying to educate at the same time they're trying to sell at the same time. It's like, it's madness. And so that's another one that comes up a lot.
That's a really good call out, because, you know, I put the sales lens on, because now it's going to confuse the seller, right? because now you're selling all three different types of functions of different things. And then also as well, I really love how the visual is there. If you're on, let's say, position three and you're selling that, then you're going to have bad fit customers too, right? And so now it's like a whole, it gets even worse, right? So I think it's actually just a great breakdown for let's figure out what our position is, align it with the right selling. What is it? Where are people potentially going to go? And here's where we want you to go.
Yeah. And it ties back to journey, right? You talk about sellers. This is why when you bring salespeople into a positioning exercise, they're going to come in and be like, battle cards, we're losing ground to this competitor. It's the last thing. I just lost a deal. And they forget that, hey, in a marketing journey, the person may not even be aware of the category. You want to bring up a competitor in the marketing? It's madness. And so you have to think about it holistically of like, where is the prospect across these stages to align what you should actually be saying to them?
And I want to make one more point too, because a lot of people will hear this and they think, if I want to be an innovative, fast-growing startup, I really need to be in stage one. I need to be doing some sort of amazing new thing that nobody's ever seen before. And that's just not actually the case. Like a company like, and also on the flip side, you would imagine all the very large companies are actually down here somewhere. In reality, like, let's take a company like Airbnb. Airbnb is actually in stage two. They're running competitive ads on YouTube all the time. I get them all the time. They're very clever. They're like, if you want to find somewhere to stay on your next vacation, don't go to a hotel. And they're like, a hotel, you all have to share the same room with your family. It's the family room. The bedroom is all one big room. Instead, get an Airbnb, which is this, to a lot of people, is still a new idea because you all get your own rooms. The kids can go to bed upstairs. Like, these are these ads that they're running. They're actually not competing against a bunch of different Airbnb clones. Like, oh, there's, you know, Airbnb is so commoditized. There's these big net, like they're in stage two and they're one of the most innovative companies in the world, right? And you can even get other very fast growing startups that people love. Like, let's take a company like Linear. They're an issue tracking software. They launched as an issue tracking software against Jira. They're in stage three. Immediately they have to say, why would I not use Jira, which every company in the world uses, to switch to some new issue tracking thing? And they positioned directly against them. And they even had these three pillars of why they were so different. They were like, we're modern. We have these collaborative features where you can all go in and see each other like any modern company. You have this command bar that you can jump to whatever you're looking. And so they were doing like feature differentiation, and they're extremely fast growing, one of the darlings of Silicon Valley. So these don't constitute like where you want to be or not want to be. They're just realities that you need to be aware of.
Nice segue into one product versus multi-product, right? Imagine for a moment, there's a company, new company, one product geared towards enablement, sales enablement. Fast forward a couple of years, they're conquering that market. They now have a couple other products that are geared towards the, you know, head of sales and something that also helps the head of RevOps. So what started with one product for enablement, now you have, they have something else for sales, which is, you know, a nice interlock for the enablement crew. And then they also have another product that product for RevOps. If you're multi-product, having started from one, how are you positioning message for multi-product? And each of those products potentially could have three different buying personas: enablement, sales, and RevOps. Curious.
Rob, do you want to talk through the conceptual piece about positioning? And then I can kind of talk about like how would that flush out on like an actual homepage or something like that?
Because the conceptual one is pretty straightforward. You position them separately because they're going to be bought separately.
For each of the three. Yeah.
Absolutely. At the very least, you're going to have different positioning strategies. Now, there's a question in there of, is there actually a group that is buying the collection of products simultaneously where it levels up into a broader use case? And this is what gets so many folks trapped, is they think that their target customers should buy them collectively, but it's not how they behave today. They're very separate in how they operate. Like you said, RevOps and sales, do they talk to each other? It's like, well, yeah, maybe we could convince a CRO or a CEO to buy them all, but then we get into a dangerous territory where, guess what? CEOs, CROs, they don't give a rip about your product. They've got businesses to run. They've got employees to manage. They've got customers to deal with. And so their involvement in product cycles, mimic sales processes, is late and very small. It's like they're just going to look at their team and be like, you tell me why we need this. And they're not going to look at your homepage. They're not going to read your marketing materials. And so the short answer is you have to have separate positioning. And then Anthony's going to walk you through how we think about, well, then how do you organize that? What does that look like, especially when you move it into an asset like a homepage?
And like even to give one more example, credence to what Rob's saying, right? Like, is there a positioning for Microsoft that spans Office 365 and Xbox? Like, both Microsoft products, is there a way to position both of those? It's like, yeah, if you're a business owner and you're trying to get everyone on this and you also want a game, like, we're the solution for you. But like, they're just different, right? You're going to position them differently.
Yeah, that's not going to make sense. Yeah.
So yeah, when it comes to, and I'm going to share my screen again, when it comes to a homepage, because a lot of times people are asking this question, what they're really saying is, what do I put on the homepage, right? Especially people we talk to, they're like, how do I actually just visualize that I have these different products, which I do? And you really have three different approaches. You can either try to summarize the value that you give across the homepage, you can itemize, or you can prioritize. So the summarize is where you're actually trying to talk across all the groups at once. And so Palantir is used by all sorts of different entities for all these different reasons. And so what's the summary? Something like this: AI-powered operations for every decision. Software and services for every business. Whether you're a small or medium business, Sage offers an ideal solution. Summarizing across, as you can imagine, and as you can see, is not very clear. It doesn't quite tell us anything at all. Airtable, unlock your unknown with Airtable AI. Use AI in everyday work, usher in a new world of potential impact. So summarize is not good. It's not customer-centric, puts the burden on the visitor. It's very undifferentiated, like you're gonna sound like everybody else. The second thing that you can do is you can itemize. And this makes sense when you actually have people coming in equal numbers for each of your different products. So if you're like, you know, we really don't have one main product. We serve these three different segments, and it truly is 33, 33, and 33% for each of them. And we divide our go-to-market dollars equally across all three. There's really no priority. And so then on a homepage, you actually want to do something like Rippling does, where they say, magically simplify HR, IT, and finance. That's their three buying groups. And then they immediately try to get you to go to one of the subpages based on the groups that they're going after. Because I think their go-to-market actually is going after these things probably in equal measure. So they're like, if we lead with HR, we're gonna drive away the IT and the finance folks, and we're actually spending our money basically the same across all three. In this stage, the homepage becomes kind of a homepage of homepages, right? It's just a directory to get you to go to one of the subpages. So itemizing is good if you have product market fit with all your products, you're evenly distributing your budget to try to reach them. It still puts the burden on the customer to look through your sushi menu to find the specific thing that they're looking for. And it's very, very risky for a pre-product market fit startup where you're basically trying to get brand awareness on all these different products at the same time when nobody even really wants one of them per se. The last one, which is usually we think the best for most companies, is to actually do some prioritization. And so this looks like, this is a funny example we've used. It's the difference between Panda Express leading with their best-selling product that everyone knows and loves versus being like, hey, check out our menu. This is our homepage. It's everything you could buy at Panda Express. When in reality, most people know them for their orange chicken. And if you don't like the orange chicken, it's very unlikely that you're going to like any of the other stuff. So they're like, let's just try to get people, if we're giving out free samples at the mall, let's do free samples of the orange chicken, right? Let them try the chow mein after they've done that. But even giant companies, Microsoft, right? I think maybe the most valuable company in the world right now. This was a couple months ago. They were leading with Copilot. They weren't trying to say, here's Copilot and Xbox and the Surface and getting them all in a giant sushi menu. They weren't like, you know, changing the world for the better, some sort of big summary thing. They're leading with the product that they want to sell. Same with Apple, another very large company. They were a couple months ago, were leading with the new watch. And they were saying, hey, we want people to buy this. And they pushed everything below because they're realizing that the homepage is a marketing asset. And so you can either use it to your advantage or you can squander it and waste it on basically getting executives happy, right? Another one, Workday. They were leading with their Workday recruiting product. Monday for a while was leading with their work management product, right? Uber basically says, let's talk to riders, then we'll talk to drivers, then we'll talk to businesses, then we'll talk to people who are ordering food. So the pros and cons, right? Prioritization is usually the best for marketing, for getting people to like take an action. It aligns with the existence that like you actually do have an ideal customer profile. A lot of times it's just hard on the executives because everyone feels like I want my thing with my P&L to be in the front. And so choosing one of them over the others, it takes a really strong strategy and really good company leadership to be able to manage that. Otherwise, you end up with committee driven decisions where you get these really watered down things, because it's like, well, at least nobody gets a spot on the homepage. We all get, you know, absorbed into this really confusing statement.
One thing I want to call out on a couple of these examples were really good imagery and photos. Like, how important is it to take that in consideration when you are doing your messaging on your site for something like this?
It's super important. Unfortunately, it's not something we directly solve, right? Like, that's, yep. It's part of the translation. That's where when you're moving from messaging strategy into, you know, in our case, we do handle copywriting, but design is a part of communication. Video production is part of communication. We have our point of view on that is if you're making a product argument, it should align to the copy you have. And in most cases, that means showing the product. The one thing that we think is bad practice, especially in B2B, is putting these abstract notions in front of your audience, or like, you know, a successful business person in a photo. It just doesn't help convey the argument you're trying to make. But it's critical. And I think you see that in our strategy as well. It's like part of our communication strategy and our content in the channel of LinkedIn, our post strategy for how we communicate these things, very visual. And we think it's helpful.
Brilliant. Considering time, we could spend so much more time diving into positioning and messaging. Let's make it real. Okay. We have an understanding of the positioning, the messaging, one product, multi-product, different personas that you sell to. What are the do's and don'ts of your homepage? Let's do a one-on-one first on how you translate positioning and messaging onto your homepage, the flow of the page, and then let's break down an actual example.
Perfect. So I'll jump in and take you through the flow and how do we get to some of those homepage best practices. And then Anthony will jump in. We've got an example to share of a client we just worked with. So effectively, the way we approach this, and we talked about it earlier, is audience first. And so we have six steps loosely in our process. We always start with audience as a smoke test of, hey, what are all the potential options of who we could be targeting? It's a version of customer segmentation. What's unique for us is we factor in what are their goals, what are their activities into that segmentation, right? It moves us more into psychographics and not just firmographics and names. And then this is where we have hard conversations. Can we prioritize? Are we going to itemize? Are we going to try and speak to all of these at once? We try and get folks to focus on one. Once we do that, this is where we move into figuring out, well, okay, if you're going after this audience, where are they in the stages, as Anthony already walked us through, so that we could figure out who we should compete with, right? Where is our differentiation going to shine the most? And so this example here is for Gong. I won't go too deep because we've already like walked out the stages. But the example we're going to walk through is like, imagine Gong in the early days as they moved down this. Like at first they were competing against, you know, call shadowing, having managers like actually jump in on calls and like quarterly training and role playing because people weren't recording and analyzing calls. And then you kind of walk down the stages. It's like, no, conversational intelligence became a known thing. And they had a position against these other tools. And then eventually they had a position of like, why are we better than other products like us, you know, like a Chorus? And so we map all this out to try and make the best choice of like, where do you think your opportunity is from a positioning angle in the market? And then once we decide, and so let, you know, for this example, like assuming Gong is early stage and we're competing against, you know, sales managers shadowing calls, then we move it into our canvas. And this is where we're back solving for product differentiation. And so our whole exercise for this is really rooted in like, okay, tell me what you think the differentiation is. We usually get like a light sketch of that, of what we think that might be. And then we walk through the product and we're trying to pick out like what really are the most compelling elements that support what you think your differentiation is. And then we try and compare it to the experience on the other side. And so what we're really doing here is double clicking into this issue of like, well, sales managers shadowing calls, like you're going to miss out on so many insights. They can't join every call. They have limited context on the deal. Different managers are going to have different feedback. Whereas with Gong, it's this whole idea of a complete set of insights based on every conversation, right? We're trying to create a huge delta between those two. And this effectively is like we've solved positioning when we get these three elements. And then we start to move a little bit into supporting messaging that moves us a little bit into messaging strategy. And then in our process, once we have the positioning, now we get to move into homepage and like, how do we structure this whole thing? What sections do we need? What language are we going to use? And so this, what this looks like in our process is you could see on the left-hand side, we're actually pulling positioning elements that we've already solved for, and we're making key decisions of what to lead with. We're not writing the copy yet. We're just figuring out what's the narrative for this asset that is the homepage. And in general, you asked about best practices. In general, you got to nail the hero. The hero should encompass your positioning and really highlight as much as possible the differentiation against the alternative for that audience. And then in terms of support, usually what we end up having are like supporting problem, the double click into the nuances of the problem, the double click into the value. And then loosely what we say is you get to highlight three really specific parts of your product. The thing is, this will always look different depending on the audience, depending on the nuance. And so there's exercises to figure out what other sections do they need? Are we going to do case studies? Are we going to introduce the other products? Those are all bespoke. And then the last step is take that strategy and move into copywriting, translate it into words, as you can see here, and then iterate on this. And the beauty of it is we're actually just doing copywriting here. We're not simultaneously doing copywriting and changing arguments and changing positioning. We've isolated for all of that. And we basically, it really only takes a round or two of iterations to get this really sharp. And there you have it, kind of like the three process pieces of like, we have to work through all of these to get to a final form.
Robert, if you don't mind going back to step five very quickly, as it relates to companies that have multi-product, different business units, larger, I know you focus on the startups. I'm assuming the strategy structure might change for the homepage based on maturity of category, a host of things.
Absolutely. That's why this here positioning anchor, it's like, well, it comes back to here. What is the anchor, right? For this example of Gong, it's the outcome. You know, we're trying to get folks to improve these sales conversations they're having with prospects. Fast forward to Gong, their anchor might actually just be conversational intelligence. Here's why we're the best conversational intelligence software on the market. We know you're shopping for one. And so, yeah, the anchors will shift. And what this starts to paint a picture of, you know, even across these stages, and a really important note to have is like, while we say you should prioritize and pick one, you may need to have and likely do have all of these positioning strategies solved across the stages. Going back to our conversation of like what marketing says, there's going to be different people coming through. Is sales ready to have, you know, the conversation of why we're better than Chorus? Because that might come up even if they're positioned here. On like, hey, we're better than having sales reps manage. And so this is where you start to really see, and it's not that positioning's complex, it's just that it's this layered onion of strategies that shifts every time you move one key piece about awareness or about who the audience is or about what product you're positioning.
Yeah. And also like we were talking about is like where the market is at, right? Like in market and having those conversations with those clients or potential clients and getting understanding of new products on the scene, maybe you didn't know about it. Oh, well, now we're in a different stage and we need to do that accordingly. And
totally.
There's actually something you mentioned, the hero, and obviously making the customer hero, right? That's a really key component here, and not making the company themselves the hero. How does someone, let's say, identify what the hero should be at that time? So for example, Ron was just talking about if you have multiple products that sells to multiple things. I think the Ripley example that we had, I'm assuming maybe if HR starts taking off, do they change that hero? I guess, how does a company make that decision? Because they had the three different personas. So there's three different heroes there. So that's kind of where I'm asking that question.
Yeah. It comes back to, I mean, you actually nailed it in the intro. It's how well do you know your market? Where do you think the opportunity lies? Where do you think your growth is going to come from? The mistake is thinking you can do it all. I want to get people coming into the market and I'm going to dominate once I'm in the market. It's like, okay, maybe, but guess what? On a homepage, you only get one of them, right? Like you can go and deliver those messages on different pages and then work different ways to get people to them. And so like how you make that choice, like if there actually ever is a way to figure that out, like you're going to be worth $1 billion because that is the choice. Like who do I marry? Where's the opportunity? Like that whole thing.
Yep.
If I bring it back to concepts, it's really about which route is our differentiation going to be the highest in relation to where we think the market's struggling the most. And that's that combination of who's struggling and what are they doing now that they're struggling so much with. And it's like it's a thesis on both sides. Where are we great and where does everything else suck? And it's like you should probably pick that combination to lead with.
Morgan's still answering the question, who should I marry? So and we can help him maybe in a future episode of getting him focused on his ICP. Who's his target audience for what, you know, differentiated product he offers? And it's a fantastic product, I gotta say.
Hey, that's a bonus episode. That's an exclusive, you know, you got the
Gents, we have, you know, maybe 5-6 minutes left. Eight, if we're pushing it. Anthony, do what you do. Let's do a teardown. We don't want to rip any company here. What we're trying to do is before, after, best practices. Someone you wanna do this with?
Yeah, for sure. So let me share my screen again. So we worked with a company. I'm actually guessing you guys are pretty familiar with them, called Lemlist. And so Lemlist, they are a sales engagement platform, cold email, cold outreach, cold calling, sequences, all that stuff, right? So when we worked with them, if we look at Lemlist before, they were positioning kind of as if they were in stage one, potentially, and you were thinking about getting your first sales engagement tool, right? Turn strangers into customers, find buyers, engage across multiple channels, convert them into your next customers. This is basically, you know, either stage one or stage two, leading with, you know, hey, this is a new type of thing and here's how it works. And, you know, we got this lead database and stuff like that. So what we realized when we started working with them is that most of their customers actually already knew, they already knew that they wanted a sales engagement tool, the people that they were going after, and they were probably better suited to compete in stage three, where it was a more mature market. So when we worked with them, we figured out we should actually lead with their key differentiation over other products in the category. And they had this really, really strong differentiation where they have this whole like email warm-up feature that a lot of the other platforms didn't have. And so what we wanted to lead with was the fact that these other tools might have all these amazing features, but in reality, if the email never reaches the person that you're trying to get to, it doesn't matter how many cool features or built-in things like that. So they were leading with this differentiation about actually like deliverability, the only cold outreach tool that helps you reach inboxes and get replies, right? And then we built like kind of this problem section that Rob was talking about. Cold outreach won't help you quickly acquire customers if you have no idea if your email list is reliable, if you have to personalize these emails together, and you're wondering if the emails are getting deliverable at all, right? Discover Lemlist, the only sales automation tool that ensures your emails are actually delivered and get a response. So, and then we started bringing out like the product highlights where it was exactly how it works and what it does and things like that. Stay out of the spam folder, right? Avoid deliverability issues and stuff like that. So carving out a key place where this differentiation could live rather than going after the very green market of people who are like, I don't even know that I want this. And this also came alongside with them wanting to go after some larger companies that they weren't going after before. Like they had been doing very like small teams focused, but they were actually finding some success in slightly bigger companies. And those companies would know that they want a sales engagement tool. And so leading with that different differentiation based on the stage was kind of how we helped them actually rewrite it.
And they're, to add here, they're a good example. They're a collection of multiple products. We're actually working with them now on some of their other suites, and they are positioning all of them separately. They actually own Tweet Hunter, which is for, you know, Twitter X, and they've got Taplio, which is for LinkedIn. They've got these sales tools. And so they recognize the need to be hyper-specific in those various approaches, and they do a pretty good job at it.
All right. Thank you. We have a few minutes left. Let's go to audience questions. The ones that we don't get to, Robert Carell, Mike Myers. Jeez, isn't that the Friday the 13th guy? And it's Friday, but it's the 14th. Mitchell, Robin, JamCon. We may not be able to get to all your questions, but if we don't, I'll get the answers from Anthony and Rob and post it when we share this this podcast. But Aaron Balsa, hello, Aaron, from the UK, formerly from the US. Fantastic content strategist. Her question, knowing your buyer inside and out is a must for writing homepage copy, of course. What questions should companies ask their audience to get the most meaningful buyer insights? I'm assuming this is something you guys do when you're sitting with your clients and really digging into the audience of your client. What are the questions that you ask to get the most meaningful buyer insights?
For stuff like this, I kind of take a different angle, right? When you're trying to understand your customer and their problems, it's really not a linear process of like, all right, I've got 10 questions I'm going to ask you, and then I'm going to know you. The very best founders and startup teams we work with truly just immerse themselves in the world of who they're trying to help. And there's no replacement to that. And the answer is there's thousands of questions. And I think about the way we've even built Fletch. We've had thousands of interactions with founders, product marketers, marketing teams, And it's listening. And it's and if I had to move it into questions, it's like, yeah, what are you working on now? What sucks about it? Like, what are the goals? Like, you got to know all those things. But there's this intangible piece of even like going back to relationships and like who you're going to marry. Like, you know your friends better than anyone. You don't know your friends better than anyone because you sat there and were like, great, what's your favorite color? And like, where did you vacation? You just live with them and you like pull those things in to where then you can start to anticipate how they'll behave. And so I don't think there's no silver bullet to questions. I truly think it's frequency, constant exposure, and just volume of interactions that get you there. And there really are no wrong questions. You're going to learn a lot almost regardless, as long as you're having conversations. But that's my take.
Yeah. And the other piece too, to think about, and Rob said there's no wrong questions, but there are wrong people to ask. Because what we have found is that when you, especially, so there's this whole concept of voice of the customer, right? And just in the phrasing, voice of the customer, assumes you're talking to customers of your product, right? So if I've been using Notion for 5 years and I know the ins and outs of Notion and I have put my entire life into there, and then Notion asks me for a quote, you know, what do you like about Notion? I'm going to say something like, oh my gosh, it totally changed my life. I run my life out of Notion. You know, everything I do is with Notion and stuff like that. And I'm going to use these really big, like, transformative language. And so what happens is people say, let's get some quotes to figure out what we want to write on our homepage. So they'll go in there, interview all their buyers. What do you like about this? Well, this solution completely transformed my business. And they're like, oh, that's great. Let's put that on the homepage. And then they lead in the H1, transform your business with, you know, Panda Doc or something. And they're like, and the problem is the average pragmatic buyer who's shopping for a tool is actually not looking to transform their business. And if I'm the person who's about to make a 6, 7, 8-figure purchase on behalf of my company, and I'm like, if I do this and it transforms my business in the wrong way, I'm going to get fired. Like, this is a very scary thing. And so leading with this giant transformation actually can drive people away who are not ready for that level of intensity. And so a great metaphor is, what do you put on a dating profile? Like, if you say you make a Hinge profile, are you going to say, I'm going to be the best possible husband, I'm going to love our children, I can't wait to grow old with you, I'm going to be great with your parents, you're going to love my parents. Someone's like, whoa, I haven't even gone on one date with you yet. This is way too, I'm leaving. That's the equivalent of like, transform your business, turn your business, you know, increase all your revenue. Like, we're going to all this drive new outcomes. That stuff is so intense, where actually probably the best dating profiles would be like, I like rock climbing. You know, I'm a good cook. I could probably make us a good meal. Drastically reducing the scope of intensity to make people more willing to see what you have to offer, right? Oh, interesting. That sounds kind of cool. And so it's like shrinking the message. So when there is no wrong questions, if you ask people who have all the context and are deeply, deeply embedded in your product, they're going to give a very different answer. The same way if you ask someone, what do you love about your wife versus what got you to go on the first date with your wife? Those answers are going to be so unbelievably different.
I would love to end with one key takeaway or thing to do come Monday morning for those who are going to go to their homepage and look to sharpen their position and message just on their homepage. One key takeaway from each of the three of you, Morgan, you're up as well. We'll start with either one of Anthony or Rob, and we'll end with Morgan. What is the one key takeaway you want our audience to take away?
I've got one, but it's not necessarily directly on your homepage. Go look at all your customers and aggressively segment them. And be ruthless. Why did they come in the first place? What were they trying to do? What industry? And then look across them all and then ask yourself, can I really talk to all of these folks at once? And am I trying to?
I'll give a much more like very low level tactical thing that I think you could do in 5 minutes. Rob's will probably take a long time and is very important.
Yeah. Sorry,
I love Rob. I love Rob's.
Yeah.
Do that.
To balance it out, yin and yang, I'm going to give you a 5-second activity, maybe a 10-second activity. If you blur out the supporting body text under each of your website's headlines, would a visitor be able to understand what the product is, what it does, when they would use it, why they would use it, and who should use it? just reading your headlines, not the supporting body. Because in reality, when people engage with websites, they are likely not reading your supporting paragraphs underneath. And if all the meat, if all the important things are hidden in those paragraphs and you scan through and you have no idea what it is, you probably should be doing some tweaks this week.
Beautiful. So you're saying just keep the headlines for all the sections, get rid of all the paragraphs below all those headlines, and then just based on headlines, can we get a sense of what you do for who, what value does it bring? Okay. I love that exercise. Yep.
My biggest takeaway from this, even for my own self, and I think for everyone that is a founder or, you know, you're a part of this strategy, is understanding what stage you truly are in right now instead of thinking the future state that you want to be in. And so I think a lot of people are like, hey, I want to be, I think we could be in stage three, and I think we're competing against all these people, and you're really not. You're actually really in stage one. So I think it's one of those things where it's like, hey, let's identify currently in market, what stage are we in? And then what stage do we really want to go to? But I think it's taking a step back, because I believe as a founder, myself, and I think for other people who start businesses, you think so far ahead that you actually aren't in the stage of position that you should be in. And so you're positioning against something that isn't even there yet. So I would say that they have that as a takeaway. In market right now, what is our stage and where would I like to go?
Love it. Thank you, Morgan. Anthony, Robert, your exercise is something I actually did in my first couple of weeks at the company that I'm at right now. And I'm not even going to plug the company because it's cybersecurity. So if you want security, information, event management solutions, yeah, come talk to me, product marketing and TMO people on the call. But otherwise, segment ruthlessly is a word you use, your customers. Because I asked a simple question of, amongst our commercial and enterprise accounts, who bought us? Who is using the damn product often? Who renewed more often than not? And then who expanded into more things because they believe what we do and into other products? This are the types of people, low maintenance, you know, we don't need to beg them with discounts and that, that we want to replicate and get more off, right? So I love what you said there. It's something most companies don't do and should be doing on a recurring basis. Anthony, Rob, thank you. Appreciate you guys. Always a pleasure. Morgan, as always, my man.
Yes, sir.
Couldn't do this without you. And this is episode 2. It's a wrap.
Thanks for having us.